Hello, friends. Colin here. Today on The Run Loop, I had the pleasure to speak with Rich Siegel, founder of Barebone Software and creator of BBEdit. Our discussion ranges from Pascal in the 1980s to stand mixers in the 2020s. I think you're really going to enjoy it. And so, on to the show. Hello, Rich. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Colin. Thanks for having me.
How's your day going? How's life?
Oh, it's a beautiful day here today. It's just a tick above 70 degrees, which for the middle of March is almost unheard of. There's talk of a record being set. It's sunny. It's got that real spring is coming like a freight train vibe to it.
Where are you at?
So I live in southern New England.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's a nice part of the country to be in.
So what I like to ask people to get started off is just to introduce themselves. And I guess my question is, what's your developer origin story?
Oh, wow. That's a good one. So I started writing code on Macs in 1985.
I was born in 1985.
Oh, great. Now I feel old. When I was in high school, we were deciding to buy a personal computer and the Mac was brand new. And we ended up getting one. It was a 512K machine with a printer. And we bought Macintosh Pascal to go with it because I had programmed in BASIC a little bit and a couple of other languages, learning how to do computer stuff in high school. And so we got Macintosh Pascal with it, the old interpreter. And that's just where it started. I did an internship between high school and college. I did a lot of tinkering in college during my undergrad years. And then as fate would have it, I actually ended up going to work for the company that had developed Macintosh Pascal.
And oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of a cool story. And the person that I'd been interacting with, they, since Macintosh Pascal, they had shipped two IDEs for the Mac, although they didn't call them IDEs back then, Lightspeed C for doing C programming and Lightspeed Pascal for doing Pascal programming. And the tech support person that I'd been dealing with was talking to him on the phone and he said, "Hey, I'm leaving the company, but they won't let me go until I hire my replacement. Are you interested?" I'm like, "Oh, yes." Didn't take me long to think about it. And so I moved from where I grew up in Virginia to Boston, took a job at the company, Think Technologies, and had the privilege of working with some of the smartest people I've ever known, working on products that really changed the industry. I don't think it's a huge stretch to say that they created the landscape for Mac development.
Yeah, that's super interesting. So you were doing a lot of Pascal at this point, working on development apps for people.
It was an interesting blend. There was Pascal, there was C, there was 68,000 assembly language, and there was some turmoil at the company. I think got acquired by Symantec, and this is back when Symantec was in the Mac software business, which again tells you how long ago this was. It was the late 80s, early 90s. And Apple in the early mid 90s rolled out the PowerPC machines. And there was some friction internally because everybody in our group wanted to do PowerPC developer tools. I mean, everybody, we were there, but corporate management just didn't see a future in it. The old narrative, Apple is doomed.
Yeah, since then.
Right, ever since then. And so some of the folks who wanted to do this work went to work for a new company that was starting up called MetroWorks.
Heard of that.
Yeah.
And the makers of Code Warrior later.
Very much so. And so these people, along with existing MetroWorks employees, built Code Warrior. And again, not a big stretch to say that they changed the landscape of Mac development.
I guess It was a very different time before the, I don't know, I guess 2000s really, is that now like every platform owner has, you know, publishes the tools to make software for their thing, and it's usually free. And then it was very different, right? It was...
It's a very astute observation. And yes, it was very different. Developing Mac software, developing any software in general, but Mac software in particular, was an expensive business. Apart from needing to buy the Macs to do the work, and of course, Macs were not cheap, you needed to have tools. So you needed, as you say, you needed to buy the tools. You could buy the third-party tools from Think or MetroWorks, which were quite reasonably priced, even though a license might be a few hundred bucks a year, depending on what you got. Or you could buy Apple's reference tool chain, the so-called essentials, tools, and objects, which was everything you could imagine. And I think that was a couple $1,000. You could buy IBM's PowerPC compiler, which was up in the stratosphere somewhere. But yeah, you had to buy it. You could buy an Apple developer membership, and the ranges for that were, I think, $500 a year, $1,500 a year, and $3,500 a year.
Sheesh. Yeah, even when I started making apps professionally in like the 2000, like when the iPhone came out, 2008, 9 era, an Apple developer membership was pretty expensive then too, right? Like you could get one for your team that was like a couple grand, and now it's $99 and you get everything.
Yeah, it's $99 a person, and the tools are free and the tools are good. So I would say that the process of the sort of the tooling end, the certain parts of the process of building and shipping software for Apple platforms have become democratized. And I agree with your observation. I think that's true for all the platforms now. Back then, it was a bigger rock to push uphill. The process of delivering software was very different too. I mean, software used to come in boxes. It was put on floppies or CDs and put into boxes, which were sold through a distribution channel and ended up on store shelves. So there's manufacturing involved. And that was just a whole different level.
It's like pressing a record or something.
So much like pressing a record.
Which I guess is like pretty rare now to do that either. But I guess you make your app and then you get it put onto some floppy disks and then hope it was a good version, I guess. You know, people go out and they're probably not going to get to patch it a lot. Or if you did, people aren't going to get that very often. Sounds high pressure.
It was high pressure. It was slow because the whole concept of move fast and break things, which was introduced a long time ago, depends very heavily on being able to rapidly deliver fixes, right? So when the web came around, it was a huge boost, not just to the old school, because, you know, we could produce reference versions on floppy or CD still, but we could put patches up on the website. Here, download this patch. Here's an update. You're good to go. And then, of course, self-updating came along, and then finally the App Store.
All those things. I'm imagining, because I've never lived in that world, I'm imagining, though, I'm thinking of things like I worked on the Reminders app, right? And I'm thinking of the first version of that we shipped, that if we couldn't have shipped any more updates for it, basically, for many, many months or ever, that would have been very disappointing to not be able to fix any of the things are wrong with the thing you made, because it seems pretty unavoidable.
So backing up a little bit, Symantec decided that not only did they want to not support PowerPC, they also did not want to keep Lightspeed Pascal shipping.
Oh, no.
And it was, it was an inflection point. C and C++ were on their way up rapidly as the standard deployment language for Mac developers. But there were many, many Mac developers still shipping products built with Lightspeed Pascal. However, MetroWorks had a good Pascal compiler. And so Symantec decided to discontinue Lightspeed Pascal. And I said, okay, well, what else would you like me to work on? Because there's plenty else I can do. And they're like, we don't really have anything for you right now. So I said, okay, well, I'm going to look for another job then, basically is what it came down to. And I was still writing Mac software, but it was more in support of hardware. So I went to work for a company called GCC Technologies and had made their name in the early days of the Mac as a hardware company with something called the HyperDrive. Going back in time a little bit, the HyperDrive was...
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, get this. It's an internal 10 megabyte hard drive that initially, the first versions of the HyperDrive, you would send your Mac to GCC and they would desolder the 68000 and solder in an adapter with a clip and a board, which would interface to the HyperDrive and to the hard drive, and it added memory. So you could take a 128K Mac and go to 512K and 10 megabytes of fast internal storage. And they sort of, that's where they started. And that product evolved and they grew the business and started doing desktop hard drives for Macs, SCSI hard drives, printers, which they were extremely good at. And that was right around where I came in the early mid 90s, for a couple of years, I worked on some embedded software for their printers. So I wasn't firsthand involved in developing MacSoft for release, but I was still using Macs all the time. It was a lot of fun. It was very educational. Met and worked with some great people, many of whom I'm still in touch with. And then after GCC, I spent a couple of years working at a consulting shop, and they're long gone too, but the less said about them, the better. Again, very educational, met some great people, learned a lot, but it was not for me. So that was like my visible professional career. What was going on during all of this, though, was in the late 80s, 89, 90, I started looking at a text editor, writing a text editor, because the editor built into Lightspeed Pascal was excellent for Pascal, but it was purpose-built for Pascal. It automatically formatted, it would reflow stuff as you typed it in. You couldn't use it for like general purpose text file editing. The editor built into Lightspeed C, which was built on the same underlying engine, also very good, excellent at plain text, didn't try to do any reformatting, but it was so closely coupled into the IDE that it didn't even let you open a file in isolation unless you also had a Lightspeed C project open. And there was no particular reason for that. It was just an aspect of the functional design of the product. The creator just didn't want that to be a thing. And so if you wanted to do anything with text files on a Mac, you had to use the text edit program, TeachText, that came with the Mac. And TeachText used the Mac's text editing primitives supplied in the ROM, and they were limited to 32K of text. 32K is not a lot.
No, not very much.
And the closer to that limit you got, of course, the slower things got as you were trying to edit, because the implementation was pretty naive. Now, the editing engine that Lightspeed C and Lightspeed Pascal were using was intrinsically much faster, intrinsically supported text file sizes up to 32 bits, and was very, very, very flexible. 32 bits, so it would be, was assigned 32 bits. So there were some intrinsic limitations there too, but you were less likely to run into them.
That's a pretty big text file, especially for 1990 or whatever, right?
Yeah. I mean, in practical terms, it was able to handle text files bigger than the machine was capable of loading into memory. If you had a file bigger than memory, you were out of luck, but it didn't happen often. So I took this and said, okay, well, maybe I could build something with this. And I had to do a proof of concept example program for a prototype version of a new Pascal product that I had proposed, which never shipped, but I had the code for this example program, which was a text editor. So I took this framework and I took the libraries used for Lightspeed C and Lightspeed Pascal, and I created this Mac application, which could read very large text files. It could print them. It could do find and replace. There was a grep library that had been developed for Lightspeed C. Very convenient. The person who had written all this code had also written a library, which was very good at iterating the Mac file system. And so I had the beginnings of a multi-file search and some ideas for how it might work. And I put all this together and I had this nice little bare bones text editor. Yeah, I see what I did there. Well, that's where the name came from. And after this proof of concept, the product didn't go anywhere. I had the text editor and I got permission from Symantec, because that's where I was working at the time. I got permission from them to use the code that I had written. And I'm looking around at the product landscape, and there were all these people out in the world saying, gee, I really want a good text editor. I said, oh, well, I have a good text editor. Try this. And that happened around a month from now in 1992.
That's what I was going to say. I was going to say a BB Edit is going to be turning 30 in 27 days.
Yeah. So as a product in existence, it's going to be 30 years old this year. As a commercial product, it's going to be 30 years old next year. But yeah, I still remember that first article in Macintouch, which was a column in Mac Week. And the Macintouch website is still going. Rick Ford is still around. And he was the one who got the word out. He was the one who got the word out to everybody who wasn't already on Usenet. paying attention to Mac stuff. And it had an address in it, which is where I was living at the time. And it said, if you want a copy of this, send a floppy.
That's pretty wild.
All of a sudden, one day, I come home from work because I'm still working, and working at home was not really a thing. And the letter carrier had left one of these big plastic buckets that the Postal Service has, and it was full of envelopes which had floppies in them. I'm like, what did I just do? So
you had to.
And then, I spent a lot of time copying the software onto floppies because, again, it was free.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I'm imagining just, you know, what I get myself into here. But I guess that probably indicated that there was demand. So that's cool. Yes. So then so at this point, is it written in Pascal, or what does it look like at this point?
At that point in time, it was mostly written in Pascal. The internals of the editing engine were written in 68K assembly language, which I had learned on the job, I think, and it's still great. And then various other bits and pieces were written in C.
Hmm. So very different, I assume, than like it is now. I assume the code base has evolved pretty dramatically.
Significantly, yes. So yeah, fast forward through PowerPC, where the 68K stuff got rewritten in C. But MetroWorks had a really nice Pascal compiler, and the code generator had been written by one of my colleagues at Think, and it's still, I think, the gold standard. Although I think Clang is at least as good now, but again, 30 years ago, it was amazing, and it's still very good. And switching over to Code Warrior eventually for everything to ease the migration process. So in 1996, most of the application got rewritten in C and C++. And over time, large chunks of the application got rewritten again in Objective-C. And that's kind of where we are now. So there's this combination of modern Objective-C code, a lot of C++, some of which is going on 20 or more years old, 25 years old. And there's still even little bits of C here and there that go back to the original.
That's why I wanted to ask you if anything made it all the way back to 92. That's pretty amazing. That's one of my favorite things that I saw working at Apple. Was I decided it would be fun to just troll through the code for AppKit, like from whatever. And it was pre the source control they've had for a long time now, but they added comments at the top of what was there previously from whatever the system was in like the 90s. And it would be things like begin implementing button. So I enjoyed that. The things can just keep having a life like that. So you started this thing as a side project and work is sort of winding down. And then turns out a lot of people want this and it just sort of keeps growing as you go. And all of a sudden you have a business. Is that kind of how it went?
Yeah, it is kind of how it went. Because what happened was that at the same time I put the new version out there, there was an email address where people could write for help. And there wasn't too much documentation, but there was a file on the floppy that explained stuff. And people started sending an email. And then more people started sending an email. And so what happened is, as anybody probably could have predicted at the time, except I didn't, the need for tech support and the need for documentation got beyond what I was able to handle by myself. So I had a couple of friends and a couple of colleagues, and I talked to them and basically said, yeah, okay, so I'm not going to ask you to work for free. How do we do this? And it became pretty clear that putting a price on the product was the way to go. So that's what we did. And we
checks
kept
out.
The free version. Sorry?
Uh-huh. Checks out. Oh, yeah.
Checks out, right? so we kept a free version because it's just not a nice move to take something that's free and then suddenly take it away and make people pay for it. But people who wanted to pay for these features that really boost your professional productivity could do so, because that's how they support that work. And really, that's unchanged since the first day we started charging for BBEdit. We've always tried to provide value for people who depend on it to do billable work, Frank, for want of a better term, right? Whether you're literally billable as a consultant or a freelancer, or if you're doing work that ends up making money.
Yeah, I've used BB Edit every job I've had. So it's been well over a decade I've used this app. It probably would have been version 7 or 8 when I started using it. It's been very useful. I could dump any size file on it and it handles it. So I guess what I'm saying is I think you've succeeded. Backing up a little bit about the documentation thing, though, is not having a lot of documentation is definitely something that changed at some point, because I'm looking at the BB Edit manual, which I think I've read the entire thing now at some point. And if you count the index, it's 434 pages currently. So how did that start? And how is it? It's obviously like a priority to have this available. And I think users probably appreciate it. But just having a written book like that, how did that start and how's it gone? It's just very, it's unusual, you know?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think part of that goes back to the old days of what it was like to ship software products. Getting a hold of the developer was used to be pretty difficult, right? There wasn't email. There weren't websites with forms. If you had an office with phones, you needed people to staff them. And so the best way to reduce your tech support load is to document the product as thoroughly as you possibly can so that customers can find what they need easily. And we used to ship a printed manual. So at BB Edit 3.0, I think it was the first version. I think BB Edit was the first version to come in a box. And one of the early commercial versions had a printed and bound manual. And so that's how that started. When you sold software as a package, you couldn't usually get away with just having a floppy. Customers who pay a certain amount of money for the product expect a certain amount of mass. And one of the ways to satisfy that requirement is to put a book in there.
That's pretty funny. You have to hit the ounces.
Yeah. It goes to questions about perceived value.
A Ziploc or whatever with BB Edit in Sharpie on it probably wouldn't give the gravitas you're looking for.
Yeah, that's where the manual came from. I had a colleague who at GCC who is a very good writer. I had a colleague at Think who was a very good writer. Sort of individually and serially, they did different parts of the manual. I've had different folks work on the manual over the years. And we've tried to make it a comprehensive reference guide to BB Edit. So if there's any weakness at all in the manual, it's that it's a little bit encyclopedic.
Yeah, but it has a really good table of contents, which I think helps because I can usually figure out what I'm looking for from there. And then it's also just, it's very clearly written. I think that the description on regular expressions, like what that is, like one of the best intros to it. It's very clear and it does what you want it to do, which is that you can read it and then you understand regular expressions, which is sort of amazing. Because regular expressions are generally, you know, I think you've joked on Twitter that you were, I said I was the only person I know who really seems to use that a lot. And you're like, well, two. You're like, you know, one other. So yeah, I think it's very well written. And I think that, you know, it's very well laid out, which probably helps a lot.
Yeah, I agree. I'm very happy with the way that section of the manual in particular turned out. And what I'd like to do someday is, because I know a few places have excerpted it with our permission, but what I'd like to do someday is maybe get that up in some semi-official way on the website. So if you want to read about regular expressions and get an introduction to them, I mean, it's going to talk about how they work in BB Edit.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of transferable knowledge there.
Yeah. I mean, they're exactly the same in BB Edit basically as everywhere else, right?
Yeah. Largely so. It's the PCRE library. So it uses that syntax, which I guess is a little bit different from JavaScript in some ways, but it's all transferable.
Yeah. It's very, it's PCRE is the Perl compatible regular expressions, right? So that's a very, that's a very common style that you use on the command line and whatnot. So that's all very interesting. And then there's a couple of specifics that I want to get at before we move on from anything BB Edit related, which is I noticed, I don't know when they showed up, but I was changing my theme and I noticed there are two new ones in here at some point called BB Edit Retro Light and Dark. And when I click them, it is a uncolored theme where it's just black text on a white background. And I just want to, what that I love that.
Like, what the hell was I thinking?
No, I love that. I think it's amazing, right? Because when you originally wrote BB Edit, it had no theme, right?
Right. BB Edit 4.0 is the first version to introduce syntax color. And for a while, there was a setting to turn it off because not everybody liked it, if you can imagine that. And eventually, there was a phase where some people would turn it off and then write in for support saying, how come I don't have any syntax coloring? Side note, if you do tech support for long enough, you'll see everything. But then that sort of faded away and syntax coloring is expected everywhere. We got rid of the setting to turn off syntax coloring. And that put an end to those questions of why isn't my syntax coloring working? And then one day somebody wrote in and said, I don't like syntax coloring and I don't want it. And I said, oh, you're the one. And I said, sorry, there's no way to turn it off. But it just sort of gave me this idea of, okay, there are people out there who legitimately don't like it or they can't work with it because they've got a vision difference. You know, name any number of reasons.
Sure.
All of which are perfectly valid. I'm not going to bring back a setting to turn it on and off, but how about a color theme? How about a color scheme, which is monochromatic? And of course, the original BB Edit didn't support dark mode.
Yeah, so that's an anachronism, I guess you'd
yes,
say.
Yes, exactly. So retro dark is something that could not have existed. But, you know, when I did retro light, which is black text and white background,
you're like,
I've got 3 minutes. And also, you just know somebody's going to ask for retro dark. They're going to say, oh, I'm in dark mode, but I want monochromatic text. So I did that.
That's pretty fun. I just love the name BB Edit Retro. I thought it was very funny because I clicked it and I'm like, did it not work? Is this broken? So I want to ask you about KitchenAid stand mixers. But before that, I wanted to ask, there's a lot of crazy stuff in this app, right? Like something I thought was a neat, that there's so many features that I'm sure nobody can use all of them, right? And like one of them is you have this deploy thing where you can have all of your text can have like placeholders. And then when you deploy, you can fill those in. You can have code that does, it's nuts. It's like a whole system. What is your favorite BB Edit thing that people, you feel like is sort of a sleeper?
Oh, wow. That's a good question. Once upon a time, I would have said it's text factories. And actually, I would still say so. Text factories are really amazing. And I don't think enough people know that they're out there, which is sort of my problem to deal with. I need to figure out how to spread the word about text factories or any other hyper useful feature in BB Edit. But they're great. Any built-in transformation, any transformation that BB Edit knows how to do can be a step in a text factory. So you can string together all of these things from
a little assembly line, right?
Yeah, kind of. They were analogous to automator workflows before those existed.
I think I have a couple that I use. Yeah, I know there's that, and there's a couple of different things. There's that, there's the text filters is in here. There's a bunch of different ways to change text in this app.
That's one of BB Edit's biggest strengths, is just being able to crunch on text any way you can think of, including writing Unix scripts or Python scripts or Ruby script, any script to do the work. The more recent sleeper feature, I think, might be the pattern playground.
I use that all the time, actually. I'm definitely going to give text factories another look. The other part I wanted to ask is, like, how do you use this app, like, day to day? How do you find yourself using it mostly?
So I use BB Edit to write BB Edit. And for me, probably the biggest recent feature that's really sent my productivity through the ceiling is the language server support. I've had a system in place for a long time that would use C tags to generate a code index, and BB Edit's completion would run off C tags, and it was always kind of rickety. But the language server support with a recent version of KlangD, which is the language server developed by a branch of the LLVM team, KlangD is just amazing. First of all, it's a really, really good implementation of the protocol, but it's just so helpful to have the compiler's knowledge as part of the editing process.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you add that feature and all of a sudden it's like, it's like Xcode or something, right? Like you've just, autocomplete on a level that is, you know, comparable with anything else. And it's, I've really enjoyed that feature as well. I guess that was kind of the big feature of the last update. What was that like to develop? Was that a lot of work?
It was a nightmare. So imagine if HTTP were a protocol that had been designed by Apple so that anybody making a web server who only wanted to talk to Safari could do so.
Because it was originally for Visual Studio Code, right?
Yes, that's right. Microsoft developed, I think it was for Visual Studio Code.
So it's geared towards a kind of certain editor.
Yeah, towards a single editor. Uh-huh. And so the reference implementation of the client side of it, the documentation talks all about how to implement servers, which are plugins. Microsoft's not very good at naming, but a language server is essentially a plugin that implements this handshake, this protocol, and responds to requests and returns. So it's very server-like. And all of the documentation is how to write a server. Nothing about how to write a client.
Yeah.
No, please go ahead.
Oh, I feel like I had looked at this very briefly before to see, you know, how you would do something with this. I don't know. Maybe it was before BBEdit had it or something. And I was like, I wonder if I could do something interesting. And I immediately bounced off it. I was like, this is so much crazier than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah. And that was my first experience as well, because when the server protocol first came out, I looked at it. I said, okay, well, this looks like it could be really interesting and really useful. And then I started to read the documentation and I started looking at representative server implementations, and I'm like, nope. And then I had a couple of conversations with a friend, and she did a little bit of investigative work for me and sort of helped clarify a few things about how the protocol worked. And I thought, okay, well, there's some really insurmountable problems here. But I now had, you know, somebody else's fairly clear-eyed look at the issue. And then I did some more digging and found some code on GitHub from a developer whose name is Christopher Atlin. And I don't know if you know him, and I forget where he was before, but nowadays he works on Kaleidoscope.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I do. Yeah.
Which is a very nice diff tool.
Yeah.
And Christopher had written this thing he called LSPKit, which was some Objective-C code which implemented the client side of the language server protocol. And it wasn't completely functional for my needs, but I could also see where it was going. I could see, oh, here's how you solve this problem. And his license was such that I was allowed to use it, and he was just enormously helpful. I don't know if he's in the section of the About Box, but I have a section of the About Box called Patient Answers to Stupid Questions. And he belongs there. He was, you know, he's very patient and helpful in answering my simple-minded questions about what he was doing. And then stuff started to come together. You know, I was able to do some prototyping. I was able to solve problems that didn't exist for his implementation because there were things that he didn't need to do, or that he hadn't undertaken yet. And I was able to bring up a working implementation, you know, sort of get that heartbeat, you know, when you're bringing up some new code. And so I don't think it's a big stretch to say that LSPKit was instrumental in helping me get over that cognitive hump of figuring out how to make it work.
Yeah, that's fabulous. It's very helpful that it existed, and also the person who wrote it was willing to, somebody had done some of that legwork for you and then was willing to help you understand it, you know, and everything. But also, I you have your own text engine, everything, right? So I'm sure there was just a ton to integrate all this stuff together, even with that.
Yeah, and there's still, of course, a lot more work to do. As I like to say, when this feature first came out in 14.0, this is the beginning of a road, not the end, right? There's a working implementation. It's usable. It's functional. It's good. There's a lot more to do. you know, my to-do list is pretty long, and there are still some interesting and difficult problems to solve. So, you know, I'll work on them.
Yeah. Sorry. One thing I really like, actually, just about BB Edit's implementation specifically of LSP is that it's sort of what's the word? It's sort of turnkey, right? So in a lot of these apps, including a code and including other things, you have to go get an extension, and the extensions are all of, like, you know, some of them are great, some of them are of dubious quality, aren't maintained. Where when I plugged it into BB Edit, I already had a couple servers running, and so it was already there, just worked, you know, because you already did that. You did it for a bunch of languages, so that's pretty convenient.
I appreciate knowing that that's turnkeyness is helpful, because that's something that I really wanted to accomplish. Over the time I've spent working on BB Edit, I've realized that there are there's nuance here, but I'll simplify it a bit. There are two very distinct classes of editor user. There are folks who love to sharpen their tools, and there are folks who want to pick up the tool and start working right away without spending any time sharpening it. And so over the years, we've worked very hard to make BB Edit a tool for that latter type of customer, because on the one hand, we feel that's more Mac-like. It's, you know, that's what Macs were all about. It's like you sit down and you get to work without having to figure out how to use the computer. And we want to carry that experience over to BB Edit. And on the other hand, we respect our customers' time for those who don't want to spend any time sharpening their tools. It's like they want to sit down and get to work. Let's make that as easy as possible. So yeah, for servers, for language servers, you may have to go find a server. And you may have to deal with installing it. And of course, that sort of can get you into a bit of a snake pit. But also what I found there is that folks who want to use a server for a particular language, such as Python or Ruby,
I already know.
They're already tooled up to do the work.
For sure. Yeah, I already had my Ruby one, I had Clang D going. So like when mm-hmm. I turned it on, it was already there. And I'm like, this is amazing. This is exactly what I want. So, you know, we're almost at an hour now. I don't want to take your whole day, but
I've got time. I don't want to take your whole day, and I don't want to bore your listeners either.
Oh, you're not. I'm sure you won't. I'm sure nobody will be bored. But, you know, we should definitely do this again. Before we wrap up, though, one thing I want to make sure to ask you about is you've been posting a lot of pictures for a while of repairing different stand mixers to Twitter. And I really relate to this, because in the early days of the pandemic, when everybody was, creating sourdough starters and whatnot, the hobby I picked up was I thought it would be fun to learn how to maintain and repair manual typewriters. So I started.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So like I have, you know, so I have a couple that are like 100 years old now that I've, you know, done some things with. And this sort of seems like a very similar hobby. So I'm very interested in how you got into that and, you know, and that whole thing.
Yeah. So it's a good question. And, you know, for one thing, I love old machinery. I grew up in a family raised by somebody who was, my dad was a scientist, and he knew how to fix things with his hands, and he knew how to figure stuff out. And he taught me, and he grew up during the Depression, the Great Depression of the early 20th century. And my mom did too. So when something broke, you figured out how to fix it, because new things were expensive. Even though we could afford them, new things are expensive, and why spend your money on a new thing when you could spend less to fix it? And so, you know, it didn't matter what cars, things around the house, electrical work, bicycles, anything. And so you fast forward to that, my wife took up an interest in antique sewing machines. So like pre-World War II cast iron Singers.
I also got a Singer featherweight recently reason from, you know, the early days of Singer featherweights, but so probably a little
machines.
Newer, but yeah.
Hmm?
So probably a little newer than what your wife was looking at, but
it could be, although she has one as well. There's a whole range of them, and she would do the mechanical work and I would occasionally consult and do some cleanup. And though that was a lot of fun, and it's, yeah, you know, I'd forgotten how much fun this is. And then one day, one of my sisters said, hey, I have this old KitchenAid mixer. It doesn't run. Can you take a look at it? I'm like, sure. Never been inside one. I have no idea what we're doing, what I'm doing. I grew up with one. She, in fact, the same sister has one. I have one, but never did anything to inside of it. But sure, I'll take a look. And this was an antique of a type I'd never seen before, but I dug right in and took it all apart, had a few, oh my God, what have I done moments, and was reminded of, again, that I guess it's a dopamine rush, that just feeling of reward and satisfaction that comes from turning something broken into something usable.
I totally agree. I did that with like an Olivetti typewriter from the early 60s recently. And yeah, just taking, yeah, you know, it's so fun to me to have something that's, you know, 50, 60, 70 years old, you know, and yep, that can still be useful. And if you maintain it at all, you can just keep it going kind of forever. And I think that's so cool about mechanical stuff.
Agreed. So yeah, and then I just started getting curious about all the different kinds of all the different types of KitchenAids that are out there, how they differ internally over time, what do they look like inside? There are a few exotic old and new ones from Hobart, which reminds me, I'm behind on my blogging. Thank you very much. But yeah, Twitter's a fun way to let some of it out in the world.
Yeah, I love it. I think it's, I've been very, like I said, I feel like I'm a kindred spirit with you in that way, of that it's exactly the kind of thing that I would get into doing. So how many KitchenAid do you have right now?
I don't even want to think about it.
Yeah, many.
I lost count.
Yeah.
I used to have a Google Sheet. I have a Google Sheet that used to keep track, but I've had a few come in. I've had a few go out. I have probably 6 or 8 random ones that are just waiting for me to overhaul them.
It probably makes a great gift until you realize that you only know 5 people that need this, and then you've given them all one.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And so I am actually at that stage of, okay, do I know anybody who's getting married or getting a new house and doesn't already have one of these? Would they like one?
They're a beautiful sort of sculpture in their own way, though, also. So it's probably not too bad having a few around. This has all been great. Seems like a good, you know, wrapping up point. But I definitely would love it if you'd come back, because I had like 50 other things I wanted to ask you about. They're technical. I didn't even ask you about OpenDoc. There's so many things.
There's a name from the past.
Yeah. So we should definitely do this again in a few months and get into it. But for right now, how would people find you, et cetera?
So I'm on Twitter at Siegel, S-I-E-G-E-L, my last name. That's probably the best place. My company website is www.barebones.com. If you're curious about mixer stuff, there's mixerology.com, M-I-X-E-R-O-L-O-G-Y.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for coming on. And yeah, I hope to talk to you again soon.
Thanks for having me. I would love to come back someday.